I have two daughters who are of driving age. When it came time for them to drive, they went to phase one driving classes, then they had to complete 50 hours of driving and get experience before they came back and took phase two of their final driving courses. And then they got their license. Now imagine if classes weren't required and driver's training didn't exist. Instead, when you reach a certain age, you're just handed the keys and told good luck. No one gave you any advice or training on how to handle the huge responsibility of driving. So then there's this. What's more powerful in students' hands, a smartphone or a license? Think about all the things a smartphone can do, where it can take you, what it can expose you to, how you can ruin your life in one simple moment because you weren't ready to understand the responsibility that comes with having a smartphone. What is our role as caregivers for students when it comes to technology and social media? Students have an immensely powerful device in their hands, and we owe it to them to have clear guidelines on how to properly handle this tool and not to become swallowed up in the potential destruction that results from poor choices.
We have an incredible interview to share. We hope you enjoy it.
I'm Jeff Eckert.
I'm Jason Brewer. And this is The Thought Factory.
So as we continue on in our episode on social media, we are really honored to have a wonderful guest with us. His name is Dr. Craig Detweiler, and he is a professor at Pepperdine University. And I was privileged to hear him at an event where he talked about social media, shared some really incredible things. He has a book called iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. I would really encourage you, recommend you to pick that up, look at it. He's got some great information there that he's going to share with us. But Craig, it's great to have you with us. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired you to write it?
Sure. Well, hey, Jason, Jeff, I'm glad to be with you. You know, I wrote the book out of, in a sense, my own need as a professor who teaches, you know, college students at Pepperdine University, adolescents from ages, you know, 18 to maybe up to 25 in some cases. And then as a parent, you know, someone who has teenagers in the house, I was just trying to figure out what it means to hand over such a powerful device to an adolescent when there's not really an owner's manual that accompanies it.
Right.
You know, what happens when kids have a device in their hands that can connect them with virtually anyone at any time, anywhere in the world? What do they do with it? How do they handle it responsibly? How and when do they turn it off? All these questions were kicking around my mind just as a person. And as I looked for resources, I found that there weren't enough. I didn't really find that I was seeing things that proved helpful. And so as I started doing my own reading and research and looking for answers, looking for help, I thought, you know what? I've done enough research now. I think I could actually write a book.
And nice.
So I don't consider myself a digital native, right? I didn't, I'm not maybe the target audience or market for the tech companies and social media icons, but I've done enough research into their background, their values, their beliefs to maybe help us all take a step back, push the pause button for a minute, and think more carefully about our social media interaction.
And you're doing some things. You're talking with students. You're in your classes, hearing back from them, doing some experiments. And you shared some of that when I heard you live. And that was very eye-opening. So tell us some of the things that you're learning about social media.
Well, obviously, I've watched the students' attention wander, right? I understand that if I'm teaching, even though I might be teaching a class on media, I'm actually competing with media, both the laptops that they're taking notes on and the devices in their hands. And I realized they were having a hard time concentrating. They were too tempted by the digital enticements that surround them. And so I ended up teaching a media class in which students were not allowed to touch their media so that we would all unite around one screen rather than multiple screens. Mm-hmm. But when it came time for exams, I decided, since we're in a world of too much information and maybe not enough time, and that the challenge for the 21st century is discernment, for exams and midterms, students were allowed to bring anything they wanted into the classroom. They could use any device. They could text and email friends. I didn't care, because that is how they will navigate the world. But the question is, how do you find the good information? How do you find the true information? How do you find practice wisdom and discernment in a world of so many different competing voices and demands? And so that was one interesting experiment that I've done. And I think it freaks students out when they say, wait, we can bring anything. I was like, oh, yeah, you can have your laptops open, anything. You're going to have to answer these, you know, five essay questions. You're going to have a limited amount of time. But, yeah, you can consult anything you want. And I think then they go, oh, well, I don't need to study. But that's not true at all. You know, you may need to study more than ever and really organize your thoughts. And have a sense of what the issues are and where the resources are.
So
that's one experiment. Another thing I started doing, just as a reflection paper, a one-day assignment, they had to turn off all their electronics for one day.
That's awful.
Unplugging.
That's impossible.
And they freak out, of course. They say, I can't do that. That is impossible. And the other people who start to freak out are their parents, who say, you know, but I have to be able to reach my kids. You know, well, what if they don't respond to me? And I'm like, well, they have an assignment in which they can't respond to you. You're going to just have to wait and trust God for that your kid will be alive through those 24 hours. You know, if they don't text you back, it isn't because, you know, they are in jail or died. You know, there may be other things going on. So once I get past the hurdles with both students and their parents, the reactions of students when they actually do this, and I let them schedule it within their own life, right? I don't try to say, you know, I don't pick the day for them. I give them plenty of advance notice. But the things they do with it, the first thing most of them do is that they get more sleep. They end up taking naps. The second thing they do is, like, if they have homework and assignments and things that they need to do, they'll read like a whole semester's worth of reading in that one day. Things again where they had struggled to catch up, they actually could focus and just get things done. The other thing that a lot of them do is they get outside and they just go for a hike and they go hang out with friends. But then they have a weird experience where they're not sure, like, where their friends are or how to connect with their friends. And they kind of have to go out of their rooms and go down the hall and kind of knock on doors. And then they realize that there's all these people in their rooms on their hall who are just kind of isolated in their own pods. And so then there become these weird moments of connection of, like, oh, we could do this any day, couldn't we? We could just hang out and talk. But instead, we just kind of text up and down the hallway. And then I'd say the last thing is that some of them start to realize that maybe this rhythm of an electronic Sabbath could be something that long term they might want to incorporate into their life. They find it so sort of cleansing for their mind and their soul and their spirit, so restorative to their being, that they say, I might try to do this once a month, you know, and it's maybe even once a week. And so indirectly, we're starting to recover the roots of Sabbath, of taking a leave of all that sort of hinders and clings to us, right? The workmanlike drive that surrounds us and used to surround us 5 or maybe 6 days a week. Well, now with electronics, we're always on. So we never get a break. And they realize that maybe I need a digital Sabbath as well.
That's so good. So good. Hey, Craig, you mentioned giving the students so much freedom in the exam time and what you're seeing them do when they have a Sabbath from their media. So how do you see it shaping youth culture? How do you see social media shaping youth culture, and whether it's a positive way or a negative way, but how do you see it from your students and what you have learned from your research?
Students are remarkably stressed out. And I think it is because of the pressure to keep up with both their online world and their physical world right in front of them. And I think they are struggling to do both. So they sort of feel like I have to follow my friend's drama that's going on online, and I have to weigh in, and I have to text, and I have to respond immediately. So there's sort of the tyranny of the urgent that surrounds them in that way. But then there's also the pressure of social media management, having to manage your own profile, having to kind of always curate who you are online and have to approach almost any event in life. You can't sort of just go out for dinner. You have to go out to the right place for dinner that will give you the right picture for dinner. It's just a tremendous amount of pressure to always be performing. And so the performance anxiety that arises from that is quite profound. And I'm not sure that sort of parents and adults really understand that. I think when we hear kids say they're stressed out, we're like, what do you have to worry about? You know, you have a roof over your head, your bills are paid, you know, you have a car to drive. What are you worried about? And it is all of these things. It is all of the social media management that is quite stressful to today's teens. And frankly, it's something, you know, we used to call it peer pressure, and we knew that was a real thing. But now that peer pressure has crossed over into public performance online. And so everything you say or do online can be judged and can almost, you know, become permanent. And you start to see why something like Snapchat would be so much more attractive than Facebook, that the impermanent nature of Snapchat, which, you know, parents initially thought, well, that's so they can send, you know, sexts, they can engage in sexting, they can send nude pictures of themselves and they'll disappear and all of that. That maybe that's true, but I think the bigger thing is that it's a little more impermanent. It's just for maybe that day or that moment. And so it doesn't feel like this digital trail that might haunt you forever.
That's fascinating to think about. We were talking earlier, Jason and I, about the fact that every platform that ourselves, but especially as we're thinking about students, every platform that we join, you know, typically you start with Facebook, then you might have Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, go on and on. It invites more complexity, it invites more voices in your life. And that can add to stress too. You hear so many people talking. So that, it really makes sense about, the impermanent nature is that's eye-opening. I've never thought about that before. What things would you say? You mentioned a couple things there about just maybe an awareness of stress. What other things would come to mind about things parents should know about social media with students?
It's a good question, Jeff. The one thing that I think parents don't realize is that they're still allowed to be parents, and they're still allowed to take things away. You know, my daughter, you know, one of her longest weekends involved having her phone taken away from her after really unwise choices. And she couldn't believe that we would do that. How could we do that? Well, it wasn't actually very hard at all. You just took it away. And it was actually, I think, eye-opening to her that this could be happening, you know, that, gosh, isn't my phone a right? And the answer is no, it's actually a privilege. And that I, as a parent paying for it, retain the right to take away. The same thing goes for, we'll call them family moments. You know, we do have a no cell phone rule around our family table. So whether that's, you know, breakfast on the weekends or dinner at night, nobody is allowed to have their phone on. And, I think we can say that as parents, like, well, yeah, of course that makes sense. But I think the guiltier party in most cases is the adults in these cases, because we're the ones who say, well, it might be business and it might be important and I really probably need to be available. And, gosh, what are we modeling for our kids, right? If we, you know, I feel like kids are taking refuge in their phones because they are not getting the full undivided attention of the adults in their life. And frankly, at this point, I think undivided attention is about the rarest thing that a kid will encounter in their life, not just with each other, but also with adults. So to the degree we can put our own phones down and be fully present to adolescents, to each other, we will have done a very subversive act of love. It's the new measurement, right? Do you love me more than your cell phone? Will you turn your phone off for me? It's a really bold thing. I add one more thing, and that is that we also turn off the internet at about 10 o'clock at night. Kids have a hard time sleeping when they have been mediatized right up until the moment when they go, okay, lights out. And so we try to give our son and daughter a good 45 minutes or an hour of no media so that they can actually get into a different kind of restful headspace and reflection.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of this phone conversation, you said there was no real manual for us to navigate through social media, to give to students, to give to our kids. And would you have any guidelines or recommendations for youth workers to present to parents, to present to students of how to navigate through social media?
Well, I think the notion of digital discipleship is still emerging. I'm not sure we know quite yet how to care for people in our online spaces. We might say, gosh, I'm just going to tweet out a Bible verse to the kids in my youth group just to encourage them every day. And there's something beautiful about that, right? In the form of, a daily devotion. I think there's power in that. But to just put out a blanket, scripture blessing could be, inappropriate at times, right? How many of us have gotten the well-intentioned, in times of grief or doubt or confusion, we've gotten this, well-intentioned Bible verse that just kind of makes it worse. It just sort of says, no, that's not what I needed to hear. It's not the right pastoral response. So I think it's very hard to do, to deal with social media, which is mostly about aggregating people's thoughts and actions and doing things in a blanket way, when ministry remains, I think, a very personal and interpersonal type of effort. The other thing is that, should God's people be maybe the last ones who believe in being physically present for each other? It isn't really enough sometimes online to just say like, or to give, the prayer icon that says, I'm praying for you. Maybe that kind of cry for help that's coming across online requires us to actually get in our car and go across town and sit with that person and take them out for ice cream or coffee or a meal. So I hope we basically won't forget that we serve an incarnational God who believes in flesh, who believes in being present, to not sort of living apart or afar from us, but decide to dwell with us. So there's something to be said for being present and ministering online, but I think digital discipleship is going to require far more physical presence as a way of really communicating the love of God.
Your book, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. Can you, as we wrap up here, can you give us some highlights of the book? We'd love to obviously recommend that to youth workers, to parents, for them to find that, get that, read that. Can you give us a little bit of insight into the book?
Well, the title, iGods, is a playful way of asking the question, have we made technology an idol? When we get more excited about the rollout of a new iPhone, than we do about maybe the season of Advent, then maybe we've got a problem, Maybe we're a little off base here. Mm-hmm. And so it's really looking at the companies that kind of drive this, Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and trying to say, well, what are their core values? What's their mission? My wife is really brilliant. She said, it's interesting, that you have all these companies are run by white men who seem to have a problem with interpersonal face-to-face communication and relationships. And they've now created a world in which we no longer necessarily need to be face-to-face. they've created a workaround. And unfortunately, we're conforming our behavior to their standards rather than the other way around. So the book, iGods, is a way of going back biblically and saying, you know, hey, God's not afraid of technology. God, in a sense, was the original technologist. Jesus isn't intimidated by technology. The word for carpenter in the Bible says Jesus was the son of a carpenter. That Greek word is tekton. So I don't think Jesus is, he's a tekton, a son of a tekton. He's not intimidated by technology. And God's people have always been at the leading edge in terms of technology, whether it means building Gothic cathedrals or embracing new technologies like an organ or stained glass, right? These were new technologies in their day. So I'm not anti-technology. I'm not a Luddite whatsoever. But I do want us to question our fealty and not bow down to the iGods way of seeing the world, to not treat each other as an algorithm or as an audience, but to continue to treat each other as people made in the image of God. So, well, another one that I could have mentioned for you all that I've been thinking a lot about has to do with photos. I think youth workers, I don't know, we're gonna have to figure out how to post things that feel inclusive and yet don't kind of write off or turn off those who weren't there, yeah. You know? So how do you say, hey, here's our group and wasn't it great, without kind of also adding that, and you weren't in that group.
Yeah,
and
right.
You didn't meet, and you missed that.
That's,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
That's real tricky. Real tricky.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that is tricky. That's good. That's good.
Well, I'll give you one little small example on that. I might have mentioned this, which is with my kids' birthday parties. We don't allow our kids to have their guests post social media, have photos or anything of the party posted.
Okay.
Because they can't invite everybody to their party. And right. So the exclusion factor of I missed it is so high that we say, well, then you can't have a social media profile about your party.
Oh, that's good.
It, you know.
Craig, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was actually just having a conversation with a guy in our office who leads a small group of ninth grade boys who said pretty much the exact same thing that you're talking about right now. This conversation happened only a couple of hours ago, and he was just talking about they feel torn because they may have a hangout with only a couple of friends from their core group of friends, and they feel, you know, there's this tension of what do I post, because I may be leaving somebody out, or I don't want to offend somebody. But then things do get posted, and then people are offended or get hurt because they weren't there. They weren't included, even though they may hang out with the core group of friends another time. It's just that weird tension between what do I post and who do I hang out with?
Yeah. Yep. Fear of missing out is a huge deal. And, man, how you love somebody in the digital space is really tricky.
Yeah.
What messages are you sending? Really, really tough.
So good. You're taking me back to when I saw you live, and your presentation was amazing. And I love how you approach that, the idea of redeeming technology and not ignoring it, not putting your heads in the sand. So once again, his book, Craig Detweiler's book, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. Make sure you pick that up. Craig, thanks again for your time and your insight about social media. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Craig.
Hey, as a former youth worker who has two teenagers, I love what youth ministers around the world do. And so I support them and am happy to be helpful as a resource in any way possible. So you guys keep up the great work as well.
So we've got one more episode on social media, and this one's going to be a little bit different from the last couple that we've done.
Yeah, in the next episode, we're going to take a look at guidelines and how we can help students navigate through social media and give concrete guidelines to how they can do that.
So parents, youth workers, stay tuned and share these, because as we're looking around, we're finding that we're gathering some great information, but we want to try to do our best to contribute to the conversation that we feel like is just beginning with parents and youth workers on how we can best help guide students through the crazy world of technology and social media and smartphones.